Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I denne ukens podcast har vi besøk av en svært dyktig vinmaker. Hun kommer helt fra Østerrike. Hun har vært tonangivende for Østerriks sin vinproduksjon i mange år. Hun er kanskje litt anonym for de fleste som snakker og liker vin i Norge, men hennes viner er fantastiske. Jeg har kjent henne i mange år. Hun er en personlighet av dimensjoner, og det er en ære å ønske velkommen, Dorli. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
You probably didn't understand a word, but you're smiling, so that's a good start. But it was very, very nice. Thanks. As we told the listeners that Austria have been a wine country for many, many centuries. Mm-hmm. It have been up and downs. We're not going to talk about scandals and so on. We're going to talk about your wines and how you discovered them. Mm-hmm. I have discovered them for many years ago, but in the wine area, people are often drinking of all habits. So they're going to the Bordeaux, they're going to the Burgundy, they're going to, but if you go to the history, you have rediscovered a wine area or wine place who's just fantastic. And you have used some time, but after some time you nailed it. And then you have improved my view of Austria. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that you're here. But first of all, we have to tell the listeners who you are, where you come from, and then we're going to discuss a little bit, how did you find this vineyard? Okay, the stage is yours, Dolly.
Okay, so thank you very much. I'm very, very happy to be here today. Yes, my name is Dorli Moore. Actually, my full name would be Dorothea. But I think that this name is too elegant for me. So Dorli is very... It's shorter, faster, and I like it a lot. So I was born in the very east of Austria in a region that is called Carnuntum. And here we are with history because this place or the name of this region has been created by the Romans that have set up a military camp close to the place where my vineyards are in the year 8. So 0008.
Yes, in the year 8. Yeah.
And it is close to the Danube, south of the Danube, but really at the Danube border. And they set up that camp to protect the border of the Roman Empire against the bad people from the north.
Yeah, of course, the Norwegian or the Vikings.
Whoever was north of Danube then. Yeah. And it was meant to be a winter camp, but it happened to become a military city and later a civil city that had in the first century 70,000 inhabitants. So it was a big and very important city of the Roman Empire. At the time, it was as large as Paris or London, but that city broke down like the Roman Empire itself, and now the village has 250 inhabitants.
70,000 to 250.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. So not everything is growth in history, we have to see. And what was left over was two amphitheaters, fantastic archaeological things, and the name Carnuntum. That was apparently already, Carn was already a Celtic word, which we were told was not a written language, but just a spoken language. And then the Roman put the ending untum, so it was Carnuntum, a Roman name in the middle of Austria. And we kept that name for the whole region, the wine region that stretches between Vienna and Bratislava, So it's really the eastern end of Austria. And south of the Danube, of course, and north of the Leitner, which is the bordering river between Niederösterreich and Burgenland. So that's the geographic thing. And what is interesting in climate is that in the region of Carnuntum, you have two mountain chains ending or starting, depending on how you look at it, which is the Alps on one side and the Carpathians on the other side. And between those two mountain ranges that go through all of Europe, all of continental Europe, there is only one corridor, where there is no barrier from the south to the north, and that's exactly where we are, where the Alps end and the Carpathians start, and there is about 20 kilometers like a corridor in between, and that corridor, believe me, is used by the wind all the time.
Yeah, see, it's a windy place.
It's a windy place. Yeah.
But that's also a positive factor. It's always. Because it's hot sometimes. Also.
Yes. Yeah. It's, you know, positive and negative, it's always how you look at it. For wine growing, it is most of the time positive because it dries down every little drop of water that we get. So we have very little infections in the vineyards, and that's why organic viticulture was very easy when I started it. I didn't know whether it would work, but it's very easy, actually, I must say. The other thing is that this wind that usually comes from east southeast and then enters to the Danube Valley, it avoids also rains to come that usually come from the west, from the Atlantic. So we have very, very, very little rainfall. We have between 280 and 400 millimeters of rainfall a year. This is probably what you have here in the first half of January.
It rains sometimes a lot in Norway, that's for sure.
So this is, it's also positive in a way because it makes our vines to fight and to produce quite intense, focused, concentrated aromas and so on. But economically, on the other side, of course, it's a challenge because we have very, very low yields. And so, yes, I, of course, as I'm more interested in quality, I'm happy with the wins.
Yeah. Because this project, when you entered the wineyards, you're related to family, to the area. You are related also that this was a project who was not commercial thoughts. It was just a legacy who have to take care of you from your
grandmother.
Yeah, yes. No. So this project here in the past that I have written some articles about it, that you have found a hidden treasure.
Yes.
But the treasure was hidden very good. So yes. And it took time to get it out.
Yes.
But if we take a little bit forward to the history that you, when you were taking over from your grandmother and so on, the historical part of it is that this had been accepted as a vineyard for many, many years. It had been sold on a very good prices. It had been a historical place. But then, of course, worlds are changing, wars are coming, and suddenly you have to fight again to go back in the history to find out the good pieces and then bring it forward again.
Yeah.
Because the situation when you took over the vineyards was not so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how was the situation when you arrived?
I would maybe go back a little bit back into history again. So at the Roman time, there was wine growing there, of course, because there was many, many soldiers that needed wine every day. And when the Roman Empire broke down and then the big changes in history, viticulture disappeared, not just in our place, everywhere in Europe. And also the Middle Ages were not a good time for wine growing. And much later, wine growing restarted in Europe, but in our region, quite late. And what is very special in our region is that we kept mixed farming for a very long time. I mean, this is something that was usual in every place where you grew wine, that you had a farm that was producing food, cereals, vegetable, everything that you needed for living. And then in the poorest places of that farm where nothing else would grow anymore, you would plant some vines. And so this is the mixed agriculture was actually perfect for keeping vines for the place where they should be.
Hmm.
And then later in history, in some places, wine became an economically interesting product. And so monoculture started. And this is how you can see nowadays in many regions of the world, thousands of hectares planted with vines. It is beautiful to look at it, but actually it's less sustainable than if you have a mixed agriculture. And if you look now into like biodynamic farming, those farmers go back to the old principle of a cycle of production, that you have animals, that you have plants, that you have wine, that you use the rest, the leftovers of everything in your own farm. So I think we see a big shift in very modern agriculture to a very old system, to a very old tradition.
Mm.
So in our region of Carnuntum, we still have most of the producers do mixed farming. So that was a way how to survive, because wine was not so fashionable and not such a big business in the last 100 years.
Yeah.
So that's why people still have their sugar beet and their cereals and their corn. And then on the highest place, which is in our case 300-350 meters,
yeah,
they keep the vineyards because there nothing else grows. So that's a good thing as well, that we had little development in our region, because the vineyards really stayed only at the best places, while the other fields, the lower fields, were used for agricultural production. So when I came there,
And which time do we...
Yes, okay.
We are...
My grandmother lived... she was born in 1896.
Yeah.
And she lived as a child and a young girl. She lived with her aunt in this village called Prellenkirchen, because in her family there were too many children, so her aunt took one. And she loved that place, and she had very, very good souvenirs and good friends there. But in 1918, so this was the end of World War One, she moved back to her original village, which is called Rohrau. It's not far away. It's 10 kilometers, but it was a long distance then.
Mm.
Rohrau actually is the place where Joseph and Michael Haydn, the two composers, were born. So we have historic things everywhere, and culture and so on. So she moved back to Rohrau. She married there a gentleman called Moore, of course. And her aunt, to thank her for the time that she lived with her and that she worked with her on the farm, gave her as a wedding gift a tiny piece of vineyard on the Roterd.
Mm.
It was 0.17 hectares of vines. And of course, then there were no tractors or cars. So when my grandmother, or later my father, had to work that vineyard, they went there by horse and they did the work. And it was really a thing, 10 kilometers, you know.
Yeah.
So it was something like a satellite of my family's farm. But it was the beautiful satellite. It was like always when we went there, I was a little child, it was like something like a holiday. And the village where we lived is very, very flat next to a river. And when we came there, to me, that was, okay, that's the mountains.
The mountains, 300 meters.
It was 300 meters high. And to me, that was a mountain. It was much later that I discovered there is also Alps.
But the wine that was produced at that time was not exported. It was locally or sold.
Oh, no, it was completely, usually it was, most of the wine was just used for a drink at home.
Yeah.
Or maybe at a Heurigen, you know, that's these places where you can buy a glass of wine and some bread. But that was the maximum.
Hmm.
Usually, like in the case of my family, my father had like 5 tiny barrels in a small cellar in our house. And he would invite his friends maybe 10 times a year, and the barrels were empty.
Oh,
so that's
a big party.
That was exactly, okay. That was the thing. And it was mostly white wine.
Mm.
We had very little red wine grapes there. So, but it was mixed plantings, like everywhere. It was more by, you know, the people didn't have a strategy or a system or whatever. It was a drink.
Mm.
And I remember very well, we had to work a lot in the fields in our farm. And my parents always, in the hot summer days when they had to work out there, they took with them a big bottle of water and put in some drops of wine just to give it a little bit of acidity, and which is much better against thirst.
Yeah.
So it was really a drink. It was a commodity. It was a daily drink, mostly mixed with water, not sparkling water at the time.
Yeah.
And it was much later when I studied languages, French and Spanish, to become an interpreter. And with a friend of mine, I did a tour through France. We went to the Loire Valley and to Bordeaux, and later we went to Rioja. And I was his company as a translator. And I was so impressed by the different approach that those people had on wine, because they discussed about wine. They told things about wine. They compared wines. They were speaking about varietals. And this, to me at that time, it was completely new. It was like an eye-opener. I said, wow, wine is much more than sour drops that you can put into your water. I was really flashed by that experience. And we went to some of the most best known producers in Bordeaux. And I was also flashed by the whole communication they did around it, and that there were guided tours through the cellars. And I was like, wow. And you know, one of the most impressive moments that I had was, we went to Chateau Mouton Rothschild. We came there on our bicycles.
But that's also always breathtaking.
It's always breathtaking. Yes, yes. But my experience was very special. Yeah. So we came in our summer outfits on the bicycles, and the ladies at the welcome desk said, I'm sorry, the next tour is available in 3 weeks. And we said, I'm sorry, in 3 weeks we won't be here anymore. And actually, we only have one question, because already we knew how we can crack that moment. And we asked, we just wanted to know how you do malolactic fermentation.
And that's, of course, the keyword.
that was something very important to us in Austria at that time. I mean, we are speaking of the late 80s.
Yes.
And then malolactic fermentation was still, oh no, this is something that happens if you don't work.
Yeah, it's a fashion word at that time. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it was very fashionable. But it was not yet in the questions and answers of the ladies at the reception of Chateau Mouton. So she became a little bit nervous and started to call around. And then she said, ah, dear, nobody is here. The regisseur is not here. And the maître de chais is not here. And nobody who, you know, the oenologue is not here. And da, da, da. But there is somebody here at the chateau who should know the answer. And he will definitely be here, because he has a broken leg, so he cannot move, and he is retired, but he still lives here. And we said, okay, what's his name? And he said, it's Monsieur Blondin. So he used to be the winemaker, the cellar master for Mouton for more than 50 years. He made Mouton what Mouton is nowadays. And we went to see him, and he was a very humble person living in a humble apartment still there at Mouton. And he was in his 80s. And actually, I have to say, we didn't know whom we are going to see. And so we didn't know. We were young students. We were just interested in traveling and wine. And we were then sitting together for maybe 3 hours with one of the most passionate and impressive and experienced winemakers of the century. And we didn't have anything to take notes, or we could not record anything, just in our brains.
It's not like today that you have a recording everything around you. Okay. And but that was the moment you discovered the wine's
that
heart.
Was that was a mind blowing moment for me, and it really changed me. So when I came out of the apartment of Monsieur Blondin, I was a different person, and I felt that I have to do something with wine. I was,
but you have done a lot with wine
later.
Yes, later.
But that was the beginning point. The start, yes. So I went back from that holiday. I was studying languages, as I said, and then the first decision I took was that all the translations that I have to do during my studies, I will focus on wine, because one of the things that really excited me was what I learned in Bordeaux is that in a glass of wine, you can detect the soil on which a wine was grown, and that was something completely new to me. In Austria, we would not speak about soils or anything. We would just maybe speak about red or white in my childhood. So I wanted to focus on that question. How is it possible that in a glass of wine, of a wine that maybe has been in a bottle for 20 years, and before that it has been fermenting and it stayed in a barrel and whatever, you still can find the taste and the smell of the soil on which the vine was growing? That was the question to me. And I did some technical translations on books and so on wine to find a reply on that question. But it still is not here. I mean, still today, we don't know. You know, there is no analytic proof of soil in any wine. It's only our nose and our palate that can tell. But we don't have numbers that prove this is limestone. This is schist. This is dark earth.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of my passion or my interest for wine. So I started the languages. Then I started to work with Austrian wine marketing. Later on, I founded my own agency, a PR agency on communication on wine. But there was still this desire, I have to do my own thing. I mean, in the end, I'm a daughter of farmers that produce a product. So eventually in 2002, I started to make my own wine. And also that, I thought maybe in the same volume as my father has done.
Yeah, just but for personal. It's a little legacy project,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, so I went back eventually after many travels and decisions. I wanted to live in Italy and voila. And then after a long journey of a real journey and also a journey of ideas, I returned to the place of my grandmother, and that's where I really started. Yeah. And still, the plan was not to make a real like wine growing project, like a winery, like it is today. The plan was just to make my own wine, to drink my own wine. But then the mountain, the Spitzerberg, told me, you have to go further.
So the mountain talked to you?
Yes.
Okay, so no, we have to discuss this mountain.
Yes.
And if you're going to describe the, you know, you told me a little bit about your background to interest and your background to work, and now you have become, you are sitting in your grandmother's little village, you have a little vineyards, you want to change this mountain to something new. Because in that path, you understood by testing and showing that this have potential to be something great. And now in 2023, you are sitting with me, who tastes lots of wines, and said, you have one of the worst, not the worst, but one of the best wines in the world by taste. I mean, it's really good. And it has become that maybe last 12 years. It has been just, it's not expensive. It's just fantastic good. So when did you find out this vineyard and you know, because you have to tell a story, because there are many small plots. It was old people. It was the domino thing of decisions. But in the end, you started as a home project with little wine, but today you have your own winery, it's your own business, it's the brand, it's coming. But it's not big. But how many bottles do we make a year?
50,000 bottles.
Yeah, so it's a small winery.
It's very small, yes. It's a boutique.
Yeah, it's a little boutique thing, but it's a kind of taking care and in a much better way than anyone else is doing. But Before we go into the commercial part of it, of the episode, when did you find out that this have potential? It was just a decision, or did you taste something from there who was good?
Well, in the beginning, it was, like I said, an emotional thing. I wanted to make my own wine. And I didn't know which is the right way. I did not know really what is the potential of the mountain. So I went to see farmers that were there, and I tried some old Blaufränkisch. At the time, it was maybe 20 years old or so. And I said, okay, this is good. It has character. It's maybe not, it was not limited yield, and it was not fantastic winemaking, and it was, you know, big bottles and so on. But there is a character. There is a very specific character that I really like. And it's this freshness and this elegance. I call it a vertical character. So it's not heavy and bold and, you know, but it's taking you up. And that was a character that you could detect even in those very simple, very cheap wines that were made without great knowledge, without studying anything before. So, yeah, maybe that was like giving me an idea that could be really, really good and really interesting. So I started in 2002 with the first grapes, which was not really great. 2003, I must say, was this first really hot vintage that we had. And we picked on the 10th of September, which was, or maybe it was 17. I don't remember in 2003 whether it was 10 or 17, but it's just 1 week. And usually in the old times, the start of picking Blaufränkisch on the Spitzerberg was not before 26th of October.
So late?
Yes. Okay. So it was really revolutionary.
Mm.
And everybody around would say, crazy. Mm.
But you want to keep the acidity.
The acidity, not because of the acidity, but the acidity because it's part of this freshness of this vertical character of the wine.
Mm.
And it was... the 2003 was, I think it was completely correct that we started picking early. 2004 was a cooler vintage.
Hmm.
And I remember that I was speaking still at the agency as well when I was communicating about 2003 and 2004. And I said, wow, 2004 is so good. And they said to me, well, you are a PR. How can you tell that 2004 is better than 2003? Because at that time, you know, everybody was still thinking about the bolder the vintage, the hotter, the drier, the better the wine.
Oh.
And now I think we really, everybody now starts rethinking and changing the perspective that after 20 years, it's really 20 years ago, we have learned that the climate has changed so fast and that we have to reconsider what we call a big year and what we call a small year or a tiny year. And I still like 2004.
But do you think the climate change have been positive in a way that, because I know if you have 50,000, 60,000 bottle a year, you can change fast, you know, you can go in that direction and so on. It's not big facilities as many modern making, but if you see to the for the quality you have when you started until today with your own words, what happened?
I think nobody could say that climate change is a good thing. I mean, we don't like it, and we know that we have big challenges and big risks for the whole world, but in very specific places there is maybe some advantages. And I would say that Carnuntum, and especially our place, we profit still from climate change, because since 2010, maybe from 2011 on, we really have only very, very, very good vintages.
Mm.
So in the old times, we would maybe have two great vintages in 10. And now it's nearly everyone. It's not everyone is great or very, very great. but everyone is very good.
But it's over average. It's
you have muffin, always.
But that's the positive part of it.
Yes.
For the moment, yeah.
You have always a good income, because in the old times you would have years with no income because it was too cold or too rainy and there were no grapes or they were not mature. But now every year we have a very, very good quality of grapes. And this is maybe also one of the reasons why the region of Carnuntum has become more important become a better quality perception because of the climate change. Of course, also because we do things differently. We pay more attention to details. We like the freshness and so on. We do better work in the vineyards. We do better work in the cellars. But the best work in the vineyard in the cellars can't make a great wine if the climate is not good. And if the soil is not the best, that's the beginning of everything.
So that's what I mean when you rediscover or finding a new spot for vineyards, that we have to be open that many areas around the world, including yours, are coming up and showing because of climate for the moment. It's serious. It's downshift. It's going higher. But for the moment, it is a positive thing. But we have to have some commercial into this podcast. And we're going to the commercial in any minute now. But after the commercial, we're going to have a talk about the wines who are here. And it smells wonderful. It's too late in the day to drink wine, maybe. It's now a little bit over 10. So it's... it's good. It's a good day, summer day in Norway. But we'll be back in a minute and we will talk about these fantastic wines of Dårlig Mur. And then we are back from a commercial and we're going to... do you have wine cabinets at home?
You mean like...
a fridge or at home?
An archive of older vintages?
In your kitchen. Do you have your own wine cabinets?
I have an apartment in Vienna where I live when I work with the agency, and I have another one in the place where I grow the wines, and I have wine everywhere, all the time. I like to taste older vintages because I think that our wines really need time. And so it's good that you sometimes forget about some bottles.
Yeah, and have it stored properly. That's good to hear.
Yes, definitely.
But we are now back after the commercial and we have to taste some wines. So could you please explain what kind of style your wines are and where would you like to place them to other areas? You know, it's not a Malbec, you know. It's not a Sauternes. So... if you want to place it, where do we place your wines?
Yeah, okay. If first of all, it's red wines.
Yeah.
And it's made from a varietal called Blaufränkisch. And this Blaufränkisch is a fantastic grape that you can find only in Central Europe under different names in different places. And it's most interesting in a very dry and very continental climate because it has... a beautiful acidity as a varietal that is supported when you have like cold nights or cold winters. And if you don't know the grape Blaufränkisch, you may consider that a great, great, great cousin of Blaufränkisch is Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
So there is some familiarity in that light-footedness that Pinot has. So if you make two big families in red wines, I would say one is the Pinot and one is the Cabernet style, maybe.
Yeah.
So this definitely goes more in the Pinot family style. But it has... if you compare it to Pinot Noir, it has probably a little bit a different fruit. It's maybe more on the spicy side.
Yeah. It have a little bit darker fruit. I have tested the wines now when you're talking. So it have a little bit darker fruit.
Yes.
So the wines are like a Pinot Noir with a little bit stronger mouth feeling. And it's very food friendly. The acidity is fantastic, long lasting, always. But then it's always coming in, even if this is 2019 vintage, both of them, the elegance. And where do you place the word elegance in the wines?
Well, I would say, coming back to Pinot Noir, definitely is a one part of it. And I would maybe combine it with a little bit of Italian grapes, maybe some Nebbiolo or even some Sangiovese, or in my case, maybe even some Syrah, you know, this this fullness of Syrah. So if you mix those grapes together, that's probably the style that the Blaufränkisch shows. And then another thing that is very interesting with this grape is that it can reflect 100% where it has been growing, the soil. So, and this is, as I said earlier, this is the big question of my life. How is it possible that we can taste and smell soil?
But if you take the first wine, which one would you like to start with to taste?
I would like to start with the village wine, Prellenkirchen, that has the subtitle Samt and Cider. Mm. And so here, I think the elegance that you have been quoting is also given by the name, or highlighted by the name, because Samt and Cider means velvet and silk. So Samt and Silte, or what is it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Samt and Silte.
Yeah.
So it's two textures, because I'm not so interested in the quality of aroma. This is going away.
Yeah.
But what I'm really looking into a wine is the texture on the palate.
Yeah.
And I like that it is fine but dense. I mean, with dense, I mean not heavy, but like silk. Silk is very dense. You can use it for many things, but it's very light-footed. And I think silkiness is the best character or the that in a great red wine. This is what I'll really look for. And Summit, the velvet, is something that comes more in from young vines. And real silkiness, honestly, real silkiness you can only get from old vines. We're having discussions, a lot of discussions with producers, and some people say there is no difference between old and young vines, and it's stupid. But I can tell because I have vines that are 3 years old and I have vines that are nearly 80 years old. And it's incredible. You cannot create silkiness in the cellar. You can only destroy it. But the creation is made by old vines.
Yeah.
And here in that Prellenkirchen Samt and Cider, it's a blend of Blaufränkisch from older and younger vineyards. So you have both textures. And I think this is what makes this wine very very full, and it has a lot of layers that evolve while you are drinking or while you have it in the glass because of these different ages. It's like a work of generations. It's like a family. You have different kinds of wisdom and different kinds of beautiness. I usually say it's very interesting to look into the face or a body of a young man. But if you want to have an intellectual discussion, maybe you have to wait some years. And this is...
so this is your approach to men.
Yes.
It's nice to look
when they're
young.
One is to look and the other one is to speak, exactly.
That's fantastic, Dolly. So that's the first time I heard. Okay. So then...
And that's what you have in that wine.
Yeah.
You have both. You have the beauty of youth and you have the wisdom and the and the serenity of age.
But the next wine is always my favorite.
Yeah.
You know, it's coming. And I've been lucky enough also to taste through some years. So there have been a change. But what kind of quality mark do you get from people who taste the wines, who maybe not know the story, how much work you do in the wines, or how low yields you have, but just tasting it? What people are impressed.
Yes,
but you are probably used to it. But in Norway we have over 30,000 wines, so it's many hidden treasures. And that's one of the good things with wines, that the price is good for the wines. The as the listeners listen to you are really passionate about your work, and you are into the details to the wines. And I don't know, but I don't think you care about anything else than the quality in the wine. Because you're going to be the legacy for your daughter.
At least for my daughter, maybe.
Yeah.
I usually say that I don't care who is going to run the thing after myself. There will be somebody doing it, and I don't care whether it's her and she will be happy with it or not, and she will do something completely different. To me, the important thing is that people who continue that work understand that the Spitzerberg is an outstanding terroir, and that that it has that many different tiny differences in character from the single plots. And this is something that I have discovered with the years, because in the beginning I only made three wines.
Hmm.
I made wine from the young vines that was called Canuntum. I made wine from the middle-aged vines that was called Prellenkirchen, the village. And then I made a top wine from the oldest vineyards that was called Ried Spitzerberg. But with the years, I discovered that in those oldest vineyards, there is also a big difference of character. I mean, the Spitzerberg has only like 4 kilometers of length and there's 300 meters of height, but it's 20 different personalities growing there.
Mm.
And this is coming back to my old passion of soil. It is eye-opening if you really taste them by vineyard plots. How different they taste. It's incredible. And I was forced to plant them because by law it's a long story. We were not allowed to do it. And only from 2019, I got the permission that I could bottle it separately, yet using for all the name of Ried Spitzerberg and the name of the sub vineyard. And when you taste those vineyards next to each other, you understand completely that what we do is just, you know, we try to bring the grape of a specific year into the bottle and try to keep it the best way as we can. But it is a result of millions of years of geological history. Dramatic things have happened there. Mm. You go through the landscape of Canuntum and you think, okay, it's a little bit boring. But I mean, the dramas are in the soil because things have been happening there. And you look at it from the top and the soil looks quite identic and the taste is very, very different because of the things that have happened then and down there. And the older the vines are, the deeper the roots are, and the more they can tell about the long history of the soil.
So we can expect more wines from you, because you're finding a new plot here, and then you have to make it. And it is, allocation is small. But I can assure you, all the listeners of this podcast, and even at Olimo, is a humble and very knowledgeable winemaker. It's one of the best buys you can do for the moment in the Norwegian market, and it will be that in the future, because she is when this is going on, she is on holiday here in Norway. You can meet her somewhere. You will recognize quite easily, because she's going to taste wines and oysters, and I'm going to give you a good place to eat oysters. We have the same passion for that. But we can talk for many, many hours, Dolly. I have it on my schedule to come and visit you and also see this beautiful place. I've seen on a picture and been on Google Maps. I follow the taste. And I assure you that you are on the right path to make your own legacy. And you have to do that to the end of days. I mean, really, because that legacy means something for Austria. It means something that when Burgundy having some pressure on quality, you have found out that climate have also raised up a wine area who, if you go back to Burgundy for 70 years ago, it was not so expensive. It was, and you have that kind of niche. I just tell all the listeners, and I don't tell it very often, you have to run and buy this once. And thank you for the visit, Dolly. And I'm so happy to be here with you. And cheers.
Thank you very much. Mm. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
Hold up. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ukens vindtips med Svein en Finansavisen podcast. Programleder Svein Lindin, produsent Lars Brenden Skram, og podcast- og videoansvarlig Marius Mørk Larsen. Ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegnar.